And so we're looking at this question of how to allow the ox into our life. And it takes on various disguises until we get the gist of it. The first area that we try to find the ox, even though it's right in front of our eyes, how far can the now possibly be from us? How distant can this moment be? And if, but we think of it, we have a perception of the ox as being something very special in some way. And so we miss the ordinary because we're used to the ordinary. We've seen the ordinary. We've accompanied the ordinary in our life, and so what? So we're looking beyond the ordinary to something that's extraordinary to prove that we have accomplished something and that we're actually being able to capture this ox. And so when we do that, when we project what is usual and normal perception for us and we look distant, all we do is get a sense of longing from it, a sense of searching, but never really finding, never really embracing, and certainly never abiding. And it's so interesting that the ordinary, the reason that we don't see the ordinary is that we bring our history to it. We see the ordinary as the ordinary because we know all about it from what we've always known about the world. And so the ox is tucked in somehow within this ordinary, and somehow I have to crack this nut of the ordinary to see it in a different way. And it's not so difficult if we're willing to just suspend what we know about the world. If we just allow our eyes to be soft rather than to be firmly directed, if we allow our sense of what we see to not be so rigidly determined, there's a kind of wonder that begins to pierce our perception. And it doesn't have to be an ambitious striving. It just has to be a sense of receiving rather than wanting something from what we perceive, or wanting to get over what we perceive, or wanting to get through it to see something that's more extraordinary. So when we set ourselves up to look without trying to hold the moment in any kind of detrimental way, when we're just willing to have a relationship to it, it opens up. It opens up beyond the veil of the ordinary, as the poem was being written. Just ordinary dishwater suddenly takes on a kind of miraculousness. We see things that we have never perceived from it and with it. And that means that the ox, we're very close to the ox. We're in touch with something that holds a different relationship to life, both in terms of myself and life, but also in terms of what life holds for me. And so this sense of the ox let's not make it too extraordinary. Let's call it forth, call ourselves home, call ourselves back to home, very gently, very gently. I spent the weekend and Thursday, Friday, I think, visiting pretty renowned teachers in this area. I sometimes get special invitations to go to teachers' events, which I really appreciate. One of them was given to me by the Karmapa and the Nolanda West. They asked me to attend a small, rather informal teacher gathering of about 30 of us in the Karmapa. So I had that on, I think, Thursday. And then Friday I was invited, this doesn't happen every day, but Friday I was invited by a Hindu tradition, Amaji, the hugger, the hugging saint, as they call her, and to sit up front and for a few hours and be a part of that sangha, satsang, actually. Both of which I appreciated a great deal. But because I wasn't enmeshed within their lineage, I could really look at it, I think, probably a little more objectively than many people of that lineage. And I had a deep appreciation for both people. It's not in any way to... But I could also see what people were projecting upon what they were seeing. Instead of just being present with the person and enjoying their humor, or they had to make it extraordinary. They had to make it almost, each of these people, almost unreachable. Glorifying awakening. Now, when we glorify awakening, we get the Son of God. We don't get a human being. We get somebody that's so remote from being human that they're unreachable. And I think we do this deliberately so that we can be safe within our ordinariness and make this sense of the ox so distant, this sense of awakening so distant and remote, to protect ourselves from what we perceive could happen to us if we got too close to it. So we glorify it. And one of the things I love about this tradition, there are lots of disadvantages to this tradition, but one of the real advantages is it doesn't create that kind of schism between the teacher and the people who are come and the students. There's a proximity there. Now that proximity can be the elimination of any respect. And I really caution that's if our relationship becomes too casual, something's lost. And yet, at the same time, it's so obvious that I'm nothing more than what each one of you are, or any teacher in this tradition. And so it's approachable, if we want it to be. It's approachable, and it's meant to be approachable in that way. But what we lose, which I noticed in these other two communities, is that the sense of reverence that's offered allows a kind of surrender that is not available in this tradition, and a faith aspect. So, I mean, you know, as Buddhism moved out into its different areas, the Tibetan tradition formed almost a different relationship with teacher and student, as did the Zen tradition. But this tradition held to the embodiment of the Buddha's humanness and continued in that way. But to understand that whenever we treat anything casually, teacher or event or the immediate moment, what we're treating it as typical and usual and ordinary. And we're not seeing or perceiving or embracing that component of awakening, of wonder. So it's not to take the moment as just as we've always taken it. Neither is it to treat it as almost a glorifying moment or a glorifying time or any representation of awakening as a glorification, but something in between both of those endpoints. Because the sacred is contained in the here and now. Now, some of us are not here to pursue the ox. Some of us are here to heal, which is fine, and to sort of, you know, just to spend some time just gathering our energy and healing to some of the trauma that we've been through in our life. There's nothing at all wrong with that, and it's perfectly appropriate for you to be in this sangha, whatever your motivation is. And some of us are here to praise what they see in others, but not to let it get too close to myself energetically. We're a little bit too frightened by that prospect. And then others of us are here to move this thing forward and to not accept having someone, a teacher or someone, represent what we know we have in us. And we're just unwilling to give credit to the teacher, where we also have that same potential, that same possibility. And to move, to be willing to move that forward and to find and discover that potential, that possibility in us, come what may. Come what may. And each of those factions, each of those people, for whatever reason we're here, I say, fine, whatever reason that you're here, just keep your eyes open. We won't come to the next stage. We won't approach the ox. We won't find the next valid reason to move closer unless we keep our eyes open, and an accompanying part of that is to be honest. So we'll keep our eyes open and being honest with what we see. That's what moves us forward. Everything changes through paying attention to it. And as we live our life and we have invested in our life being invested in livelihood, invested in children and family, invested in whatever we have, and we think that if we get too close to the ox, we'll be robbed of what these precious treasures that we've already collected. And so we kind of keep the practice distant, and at the same time, we're not really showing up and being present for what it is that's happening in our life so that we can see that family, job, or whatever isn't going to provide the lasting happiness that we have invested in it. And if we do that, then we're fixed between two possibilities here. We won't give ourselves over to our family in a way that allows a true, genuine observation of whether this is really going to make me happy, or job, status, whatever it is that we're pursuing, to see if this is really going to make me happy, and to trust that awareness and honesty will show us whether it will. And so when we kind of, well, we sort of distancing ourselves from that, and then we distance ourselves from the ox as well because we're a little afraid of what the ox might show us, we're not showing up for either equation of it. And so the ox can't access us. It would access us through the family if we just kept our eyes open. We gave ourselves over to that and just kept our eyes open and just asked relevant and discerning questions about whether true happiness lies in this pursuit. It doesn't say anything about how much I love my family or how much the job worth is or whatever. It just is asking a very relevant question to any experience in life. Will this experience be completely satisfactory or not? And what happens is that when we see that it's not, we don't divest energy from it. We just start divesting energy in it in the right direction. Rather than trying to find the perfect family, the energy goes in absolutely allowing it to be the way it is. And when we do that, we actually come closer to the family. Rather than to meet our expectations and our disappointments and our bitterness because we're not giving over ourselves sufficiently, when we can perceive that the family, from investing in the experiences of having a family and in the joys of having money, are not going to make me happy, then we can really reorient our posture to those very things in a way that brings the ox forward. Okay, so this is the way the family is. Instead of trying to constantly rearrange so that the great payoff is made, it's never going to happen. So now I can be with the family as it is, rather than try to milk it toward that great eventual happiness that I think it might contain. It's not going to contain it. So now I can just be with it as it is. And as soon as we're with it as it is, we find that the distance we have to it becomes very near. Become very near it. So we don't. It's not like we have to say, "Oh, the family's never going to give me complete satisfaction. Therefore, I'm going to go be a nun." No, we just stay with the topic at hand and look at it in a different way. relax with it and allow it to be itself. And then we come out of hiding and we have a resurgence of attention for what is there, and the ox comes forward. So just keeping our eyes open, asking questions and being honest with wherever that may take us, begins to move us closer to the ox. But the timing of the ox is entirely it. It's not ours. We can't force ourselves ambitiously towards the ox. We can't create this kind of frenetic activity and work diligently to discover the ox. The ox's time, not our time. It's like a deer that you might meet in the forest. If you try to go towards it, it skirts off. But if you sit quietly and just rest and perhaps put morsels of food around, it may come very near. But it's not going to come near if you have any ambition for it to come near. It comes near on its own, in its own timing. And so does the ox. And I think this is one of the great mistakes that many of us make, that the sense of me, when I have my own timing for this thing, really drives the ox away. This sense of me has to give up its own timing. Now, that doesn't mean that it becomes complacent. It forms the intention for that ox to come close, for that relationship to be endearing. And the intention is what brings the ox closer to. That's the food from which the animal will feed. But if I become too ambitious in my need for that ox to get closer, then we are very, very separate from it indeed. You see, the problem is that we have an eye, a sense of eye, that wants to be aware. And we have the eye and we have awareness. We have the sense of me and we have the ox. The eye is the embodiment of the lack of awareness. So the embodiment of the lack of awareness, how does the embodiment of the lack of awareness bring awareness towards it? It's paradoxical. It can't happen, can it? What we have to do is become very quiet in ourselves, and what we find is that when we become less of ourselves, less to ourselves, the ox arises. But if I, the sense of I, become ambitious in getting the ox, it hardens the sense of I and diminishes any ox that's close by. You see the formula there? And it's a very important formula. Another way of saying it, and I'll say it in different ways to help with the understanding of what's happening here, is the conscious and the unconscious. The sense of I is really an unconscious part. It's an unconscious expression of mind. We think we're something we're not. That means we're not conscious to what we are. So the unconsciousness tries to bring consciousness to it. How can the unconscious bring consciousness to it? The conscious has to bring the unconscious to it, doesn't it? It has to go the other way around. Awareness has to invite the unconscious. The unconscious can't bring awareness to it because it's not conscious. But consciousness. And so how does consciousness make the unconscious conscious? Are people following this? It doesn't do it with tension because tension is unconscious. It doesn't do through ambition because all of that is the self, the unconscious sense of self driving itself forward. It does it through being simply conscious, making conscious a home. Consciousness, awareness, is a home. And then as the unconscious comes through the conscious, it wakes the unconscious up. Like, I don't know, I can't think of a good analogy of it, but... So in our willingness to allow ourselves to be conscious, the unconscious part of ourselves comes forward into that consciousness and it lights up. We begin to perceive what is there. We do it through invitation. We do it through just seeing. We do it through understanding, not force. Not, you see, because all of that is from the unconscious part. I cannot force myself to let go. I can only understand why I need to let go. See? So there I'm trying to show how this whole thing works itself out. What we usually try to do is we work it out. But the unconscious sense of me simply cannot do that. It doesn't have the faculty to be able to do that. And so we just have the intention. And we develop the methodology of just sitting, keeping our eyes open, and being as honest as we can to whatever it is that's occurring. And never taking full accountability with what's occurring. And from those, that system are the horizon of the conscious broadens and expands on its own. On its own. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so discussion around what it is that's keeping you from the ox. Why? What is it? How do we live our lives so that we distance ourselves from the very practice we're trying to encourage here? So any revelations, insights into that? Yes. You don't trust yourself to recognize what's happening in the present moment?
Yeah. For real. I mean, to really know that this is, what is happening is what's happening.
Well, start where you are. You don't have to be any better than you are. Whatever you think is happening, stop there and look and see. In other words, we're not looking for some ultimate piercing vision of the present moment. We just take it what it is and see where you're limiting what is through your expectations, fears, and wants. That's all. So don't be afraid to perceive because you're afraid of what you perceive will be false or not, or that you don't have the act. You have the ability. Each of us have to start at some point, at the edge of our ignorance, at the edge of what we think is happening, and then pursue through our own inquiry, through our investigation, if this is in fact what is happening, right? So I say, for instance, this person is thinking something about me. As if I could possibly, okay, so that's the assumption I'm making of the present moment, but let me look at that. How could I possibly know what that person is thinking? If I look at it, I couldn't. And secondly, if I look even closer, it's because of what I am afraid of him perceiving, that the pain that I have in myself. So I begin to perceive the pain I have in myself has a distorting quality in what I think other people are perceiving of me. So at some point, as we begin more refined in our ability to discern, we see that I can't trust what I'm thinking somebody else is thinking of me. I can trust the pain of what I'm feeling in myself about me. And I can look at that and see whether that's true. And I just keep taking or loosening a layer of the onion, of the unconscious, which has configured the moment in a certain way. And I keep peeling back layer upon layer of the unconscious by making it conscious, by asking questions about it. Let's just look at this thing. Until finally you get to the mystery itself. You see? So unless we're willing to actually explore the moment, without whitewashing it, you don't trust it. Well, why don't you trust? Look and see where it is that you are misperceiving it, how you're misperceiving it. Don't just whitewash and say, I can't look at the moment because I don't trust that I see it correctly. That's where we all start, you see? And then just start bringing it closer to you. We all misrepresent the ox, all of us. All of us think that the ox is something it's not. And that's the whole exploration of the Dharma, is exploring how it is that we bring ourselves to the moment in place of having the ox there. We have embodied ourselves in the moment rather than the ox through our projection. And it's a transformation. It's an alchemy that happens where we transform into the ox by asking those relevant questions of what we are bringing to the moment. Yes?
I'm finding that I'm becoming more aware of the old patterns and habits that I've done for my whole life.
Yes.
Just pop up and, you know, I follow them down the path by halfway. Whoa, what is this?
Yes. What is this? The point there is that he's seeing habits that have been in place for a long period of time. And the recognition of new habits means that awareness is accessing something that it hasn't seen. Because before you weren't even aware that those habits were persistent. And now you're catching, not only catching the fact that they're happening, but also interrupting them. See, that's the transformation that's occurring. Where you say, what am I doing this for? I've always done it, so what am I doing it for? What am I doing this for? Have you ever, don't you see that thing? Yeah, right. What's going on here? Why am I doing this? And I don't know. You just don't know why you're doing it. So to look at those.
Yeah. So it occurs to me a lot like addiction, in that self-indulgence, it may not be ultimately fulfilling, but there's a pleasure or a relief or a moment of the escape itself that keeps, for me, it keeps drawing me back unconsciously. And I mean how I distance myself from the ox is constantly going back to, you know, even with the realization that, you know, this isn't ultimately fulfilling.
Just to summarize that question or comment, is that sometimes we get caught lost in patterns of indulgence. And I mean, I don't care about the ox in that moment. I care about just bathing myself in the pleasure of it, right? And there are many times like that, isn't it? Just keep your eyes open. Okay, so I'm not saying that there aren't many of those occasions for all of us when we will journey into the thinking realm, the conceptual realm, you know, just to give us some relief to the stress that we might have been under all day long or whatever. And but if we look at what we expect to happen, what we expect to get from that indulgence, just see if we're getting what we expect to get. Just see if the payoff is worth the price, right? So, and see what it does, because it is an addiction. See how it trains you to look at life in a particular way. That's part of keeping your eyes open, is the how it allures you again and again into its trap, and how you keep giving away to your disadvantage a clarity for that occasion. So you may not catch that the first time, but after the 150th time, begin to see how you are giving part of yourself away. And part of yourself isn't lighting up, right? And that still doesn't mean that from time to time you don't indulge. But when you're aware during the moment of indulgence, it's not quite as blinding, like a hot tub, right? It's like knowing that you're aware of being comfortable isn't quite as pleasurable as the unconscious belief that this, you know, this is it, right? Because it holds a limit. Unconsciously believing that this is it, holds the belief that this can last, doesn't it? And that you can just remain there. The conscious aware of indulgence knows that this isn't going to last. And therefore, there's not this, the same sense of grasping as it. So, but keep your eyes open in that. And then, sometimes, try not to be aware. Okay, I'm going to do this thing, and I'm not going to be aware. And see how successful you are at not being aware of it. Once you turn on the faucet, you really can't, it's like it has a washer loose. You can't turn it off. All you can do is turn it on more, or keep it where it is, but it doesn't go back the other way in the same way. And so once you let the genie out of the bottle, it's there to stay. It's there to stay. And so that's what we have going for us, except the genie really shows us the limitation on an ongoing basis of all the ways that we have used our life. And so it's, and we can't get lost in it in the same way because we're partially conscious to it, and so it just keeps walking itself in that door. Yes. Staying in the present, in the busy hubbub of life, things that have to be planned for and things that have to be, right? And postponing the ox because of the pressures of life and the busyness of what, right? As if those things wouldn't get done, and this is an assumption, wouldn't get done staying in the present. That we have to, The assumption is there that I have to think about the future in order for the future to be resolved. Right? You have to test that theory. You have to test that theory that the present doesn't take care of the future just by abiding within it. It's going somewhere. Where is it going? It's going into the future. It's the only place it can go, right? And so when we lose ourselves, we lose ourselves in the tension of what we want to occur and when we want it to occur. We lose ourselves into the next thing, the busyness of the world, so that we are completely disassociated with our life here and in the future sort of reigns supreme. I mean, I take the simplest activity and you'll see that occurring. Take the moment in which you're moving your hand towards something and seeing how conscious you are of the movement of your hand as opposed to where the hand is supposed to land and what it's supposed to do once it has grasped whatever it's. See, we miss so much of life on a minute scale. Now, if you take that and you multiply it in urgency and in importance by getting your child to school, you can see that we're not even set up to be in the present. We're set up to lose it completely and to put all of our dynamics and all of our fears embedded in the future so that we have no way to recall ourselves to see if the present could even give us a better transition to the future than just futurizing. Do you see what I'm saying? Try it. See if that's so. Don't just say, I can't do it because the pressures are too great. I mean, that's whitewashing. And so start taking apart the smallest of activities and see how we give ourselves away when the pressures aren't so great. We're just used to giving ourselves away. So, of course, when the pressures are great, we're going to give ourselves away even quicker because we have no foundation to be able to build upon the present. Because even in the smallest activities, we aren't present. So I want to know where I am when I'm reaching. Not in the turbulence of multitasking. Because turbulence of multitasking, that equation of how I give myself away, is contained in the simplest of the reaching. And if I understand what I'm doing in this movement, I will understand what I'm doing when 10,000 things are being asked of me. It's the same thing except multiplied in intensity. Why am I giving away this moment? Why am I moving from what is actually occurring? See, we have to see what it is that we expect to benefit by giving ourselves away. Because there's something If I'm not present to that, what is it that I'm present to? I'm present to what I'm going to get when I get that. So I'm present to something that isn't even present. It's an idea that may or may not turn out to be the actual experience when it occurs. And so I'm giving myself away for an idea. Now, why would I be giving myself away to an idea? Why would I do that? Why would I give myself away? It's because my mind is not relaxed and at ease. It's waiting for something to arise that it considers to be an advantage over what is present. So I'm just playing cards here. You know, I don't want to get stuck with the old maid. So I'm giving the old maid anything but the old maid. So we keep giving away the old maid of the moment for any other card in the deck. You see, there's a lot of reasons why we escape the moment. That's just a very, very cursory glance. One of the reasons is I'm not comfortable with myself. When I'm in the moment, I have to see myself. Who else is there to see? If I can't go forward in concept, I have to be with the present sense of me, which I'm not particularly appreciative of. So of course I'm going to bypass that into something. See, it goes on and on and on and on. And we have to recover all that. We have to see what's the... So look for it in the simplest of the moments. In the simplest of the moments.